Sometimes puppets can say things that people can't. Puppeteers from all over the United States are gathering this week in West Liberty, Iowa for the Great Plains Puppet Train. And today, we'll get a preview. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Neppe. Puppet shows for kids, puppet shows for adults, puppet shows about science, puppet shows about loss. The Great Plains Puppet Train will have something for everyone and a few things that are hard to imagine. I'll talk with Monica Leo of Eulenspiegel Puppet Theater in West Liberty and some of the performers coming from around the country. Then later in the hour, I'll talk with animal behaviorist and best-selling author Temple Grandin about why we need more autistic people in the workforce. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Neppe. Later in the hour, I'll talk with animal behaviorist and best-selling author Temple Grandin about why we need more individuals who are on the autism spectrum in the workforce, not just because they need job opportunities, but because society needs them and their skills. That's coming up later in the hour. But first, puppeteers from all over the United States are traveling to Iowa right now. They're coming for the Great Plains Puppet Train, a regional puppet festival in West Liberty, Iowa. It begins tomorrow and runs through Sunday the 16th. I will visit with some of the artists who will be performing. And my first guest today is a performer, an organizer, and a beloved member of the West Liberty community, Monica Leo of Eulenspiegel Puppet Theater in West Liberty. Welcome back to the show, Monica.
Thank you, Charity. I'm glad to be here.
Now, the Great Plains Puppet Train is a festival for puppeteers, but explain a little bit what happens.
Well, it's a regional puppetry festival for the Great Plains region, which is one of the eight regions that are part of Puppeteers of America. The main organization, Puppeteers of America, holds national festivals every other year. And then most of the regions have regional festivals in the years in between. I should say the ones that where somebody steps up and says, yes, we'll sponsor the festival, because it's basically a pretty much a volunteer-run thing. And we have a wonderful group of puppeteers that are coming to perform at it and teach workshops.
All right. And it happened in West Liberty back in 2012.
That's
so
right.
So here we are again. Why come back to Iowa so soon?
Well, our region is somewhat sparsely populated with puppeteers. And in the last number of years, it seemed as if our regional festivals have kind of gone between St. Louis, Minneapolis, and West Liberty. And of course, West Liberty is the smallest town,
yes,
as I know of, have ever hosted a regional festival in any of the regions.
Wow, so, and a lot smaller than St. Louis or Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah.
But what makes West Liberty a great place to hold a festival? Because it is quite a small town.
It's small, but we have a lot of really good community support, and it's a really diverse community. And partly because it's such a diverse community, it's a pretty open-hearted community. People are used to having strangers in town and like having strangers in town. And our puppet company's been there for, I think, about 21 or 22 years now. So they're kind of used to seeing puppeteers, too. It doesn't freak them out.
So you mentioned workshops. Are those workshops that other puppeteers are participating in, or are the members of the general public also part of that?
The workshops are, for the most part, open to people who've registered for the whole festival. Now, you don't have to be a puppeteer to register for the whole festival. Anybody can do that. But one of the workshops is open to local kids. That one will start tomorrow afternoon after school and continue Friday after school. It's also open to the puppeteers that are attending. But the other workshops are essentially only open to the people that have registered for the full festival. But the performances are open to the public.
All right. And there are lots of performances,
right? There's 13 shows, I think, now between now and Sunday morning.
Wow. And of course, I mean, you mentioned after school, during the work week, it's hard to really get an audience. Are they all in the evenings?
They're not. We have two on Friday that are for school kids and festival attendees. And we have all of our fourth graders attending Cellula by Z Puppets Rosenschnaz, and all of our fifth graders attending the K-Tech the Wizard by Brian Animations Living Entertainment. And
wow,
you'll be talking to Brian in a minute.
Yes, and I'll be talking,
Sherry,
we'll talk about Cellula in just a second as
And
well.
Then Friday evening, we have a marionette artist, David Simpich, And Saturday, we have 5 shows that are open, free and open to the public as part of the West Liberty Children's Festival. And then Friday evening, Saturday evening, we have one that's for teens and adults, My Grandfather's Prayers by Red Herring Puppets from Asheville, North Carolina. That sounds like it's going to be a really interesting show. And then Sunday morning, we're finishing off with Hunter Marionette's A Penguin in My Pocket. And that one's for families.
Nice. Well, I want to bring Sherry Aronson into the conversation. Now, she is co-creative director of Z Puppets Rosenschnauz of Minneapolis. And she and her husband, Chris Griffith, will perform the puppet show called Cellula. It's probably unlike anything you've ever seen before. Hello, Sherry.
Hi. Hi, Sherry. Hi, Monica.
Hi, Sherry. Brian's here, too.
Thank you so much for being here, Sherry. Can you describe, I mentioned that Cellula is probably unlike any other puppet show that any of us have seen. Explain what it is.
Well, a lot of times when people hear the word puppet, they think of puppet on a strings or marionettes, which you can see at the festival, or they think of maybe the Muppets, so like a moving mouth talking animal or talking person, and I'm sure you can see that at the festival too. But there's so many different things a puppet can be, and in our show, a puppet is a glow-in-the-dark cell that goes through cell division. And it doesn't have a face. It doesn't have a moving mouth. It doesn't speak any words. But still, after the show, kids come up and say, I want to see Cellula. Can I meet Cellula? And that's part of the magic of puppetry.
Well, let's play just a few seconds from the show. This cell division play is accompanied by an a cappella performance along with it. Let's listen to what it sounds like.
Inside me, inside you, right now, there's a cell waiting to begin. When she's ready, Cellula will join the trillions of cells that work together to make you come true.
All right, just a moment from the puppet show, Cellula. Tell me a little bit about the sounds that we were hearing. I mean, obviously, I mentioned an a cappella performance. We hear sort of a musical soundtrack. We hear the narration as well. What do we hear?
Yeah, well, what we like to think of the sound in Cellula is as if you put a microphone down to the cellular level. And we're using our imagination to ask the question, what would cells sound like at that level? And our improvisational vocalists, Monkwe Ndosi and Libby Turner, have an incredible range of sounds and musicality that they draw from as vocalists to create harmonies, to create sound effects, and really a full soundscape for following the cell along as the cell divides. As we really take the audience into the world under the microscope through all the senses.
Where did you get the idea for this show?
Well, my parents are scientists, and this is my homage to my parents, and especially my mom, who taught me about genetics, and she was the first one who showed me what something looked like under the microscope. And so this is my retelling in a more expressionist way of what that experience was like, of discovery, of hearing the story and seeing before my eyes these you know, parts of life that are too small for the eye to see.
And I think anybody who's gone through biology class has heard this story. Why do you think it lends itself well to a puppet show?
Well, I was really interested in finding out what is the smallest unit of drama that we could put on stage, you know, and taking that literally, the cell is the smallest unit of life. And what I found fascinating is, you know, it's an incredible process. It's so balanced in terms of timing and when different parts of the action happens, and it's all cued by different elements of our own chemicals, but it's happening all the time inside of us, and we never think about it. So this incredible phenomenon is happening all the time, and we're not thinking about it. So I wanted to really give us all a moment to sit with ourselves and just bask in the marvel that's happening inside of us all.
Well, and of course, people who are going to be part of this festival in West Liberty are going to have an opportunity to see a lot of different kinds of puppet shows over the period of the festival. Why do you think puppets are relevant today in 2018?
Well, I think that puppets really they bring us to our pre-verbal self. They bring us back to that point of innocence where it is able to express things that we can't express with words. And we're able to express them with images combined with sound, combined with action. So it really takes us beyond, you know, what we're able to convey in just words and text messages and emails and you know, those quick exchanges that we're immersed in our lives, and we're able to just take us through communication that just really sparks the heart and the soul and the brain all at the same time.
Knowing that you can put on a performance about cell division and really get an engagement from the audience, it's fun to watch the video online and listen to the audience, because you can hear them responding to the show, laughing, and really clearly very engaged with what they're learning. Does that give you ideas about what you may be able to perform in the future? Do you have another dream show?
Well, there's a dream show a minute. So yeah, I think that all of life lends itself to be expressed through puppets, and I especially love finding something that either people don't understand or people take for granted, and then putting that on stage. And we had scientists come to the show, people who've devoted their whole lives to the world under the microscope, and say, I got new insights from seeing it on stage, because you're doing things that we can't do in the laboratory of switching between magnification levels so quickly. And that I think is really great, to be able to bring in people who may feel like they don't know anything or don't understand it, to people who are experts, and give everyone along that range an experience.
Sherry, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Come to the festival.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about the Great Plains Puppet Train right now. It's a regional puppet festival taking place in West Liberty. It begins tomorrow, runs through Sunday the 16th. There are puppeteers from all over the place making their way to Iowa right now. Just a few minutes ago, I was talking with Sherry Aronson, who is the co-creative director of Z Puppets Rosenschnauz of Minneapolis. She and her husband will be performing a show called Cellula about cell division. And up next, we have Brian Hull. He is the director of Bry Animations. He's also the puppeteer, the staff puppeteer of the Nashville Public Library. He'll be performing K-Tech the Wizard, which is an adaptation of a 1933 children's book, at the festival. He is with me now. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here.
Well, first, let's talk about K-Tech the Wizard.
Sure.
As I mentioned, it's an adaptation of a 1933 children's book, and this is a book that sort of was recently introduced to American audiences, right?
That's right. It's only been in English for 6 years. And the way I came across it, I work at the Nashville Public Library, and a cart of new books came in, and on the top was this book, K-Tech the Wizard, with this boy wizard with a scar on his head, invisibility cap, sorcerer's stone, flying car. And I thought, oh, what is this, some Harry Potter ripoff? And I opened it up and it said copyright 1933 by Janusz Korczak. And then I read the foreword and I was completely hooked.
What did you read there?
Well, you know, I could...
You don't have time to read the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't have time to read the thing. Yeah. But, this is a difficult book. I dedicate it to all the restless children. It goes on and on and on. It's he says, maybe one day I will write the ending to this book. So I started reading the story, and there's the story he's telling, but then there is something else that he's doing. And then I thought, who is this man? I never heard of him. And I found out his story is incredible as well. He was a child's rights activist in the early 20th century in Warsaw. He started an orphanage with 200 children, got moved into the ghetto. He's a hero for the Holocaust for children. He defended the children. His whole approach was children are the same as adults. Children don't grow up to be people. They are people already. And he was beloved in Europe. And I thought, how do we not know about this guy?
And he perished during the Holocaust.
Yeah, he refused to leave the children. He was offered freedom many times. You do not have to go with these children. And he stayed with them. He said, you don't leave a child when they are sick and you don't leave them at a time like this. And then I thought, how do we not know about this guy? But then also there's what he said and there's what he taught about the respect for a child and that, you know, children have the capacity to understand as the same as adults, they just have to be shown how to be. And that's kind of what K-Tech the Wizard is about. That he is a wizard is really beside the point. He takes on these wizardry powers, but he has to learn that with this power and as an adult, and as you grow up, there is responsibility and there are lessons and there's a bigger world that you have to find. So it's really a wonderful, wonderful book. And I sort of became obsessed with it. And here it is.
And I had Sherry describe her play, glow in the dark, black, right. Black light, and, all kinds of things going on. Your performance is a little more traditional.
Yes.
So tell me what your show is like. What's your artistic approach as a puppeteer?
Well, because it's a European tale, I try to take a more European approach to puppetry. The puppeteers are seen the entire time. When I've gone to Europe and seen a number of puppet shows, and never did they try to hide the puppeteer. They
All
see
right,
the
so
puppeteer.
You're not down on your knees behind
right,
them.
Right, right. Okay. I see your hands. You don't worry about that. And it's a tabletop style of puppetry where the puppeteer is part of the performance. And then we also take on characters in the story as well. But the entire thing, the entire show, because I do animation, my company's Bry Animations, mm-hmm. has projected animation behind us. So we're able to do things and we're able to show parts of the story through animation and through music. And it's all timed to this thing that we've created, this gigantic package that tells the story. So it's a combination of many different types of entertainment is, and there's one thing that's also significant is the music is all original and recorded in a studio in Nashville. And we just got these tremendous musicians. The music is composed by Sarah Hart, who is a wonderful sort of Catholic folk singer. And, her music is she's sort of the master of melancholy. And it's sort of like these beautiful, happy, sad songs that really tell this, lend so much to the story and sort of put it all together. It's really, when Korczak wrote it, he wrote it as a series of short stories that were published in a children's magazine. So the story's kind of all over the place. And the challenge was to put it together into a book. Into a story that, follows a more traditional line.
Narrative,
yeah. Right.
So I'm curious, what drew you into puppetry? You were a performer first. What was it about puppetry that made you want to perform in this way?
Well, yes, I was a performer for a long time. I worked at Opryland Theme Park in Nashville, and I created a children's character. And started writing children's stories. And then I got the job at the Nashville Public Library. And then also with Dollywood, I write and adapt children's stories into plays and puppet shows for Dolly's Imagination Library. But the thing about puppetry is you can do anything. there's this great idea that actors act and puppets are. And I think that that's the truth of it, is that, no, that is not some famous actress as Cinderella. That is Cinderella. And it can be nothing else. And sort of the purity of what that puppet represents transcends, you know, like Sherry said, you know, transcends languages. I've seen puppet shows in languages I don't understand, and I'm moved by them because of the puppetry and the skill of the puppeteer. I've seen so many wonderful puppet shows that would sort of change anyone's idea of what you think puppetry is. And that's kind of what I'm trying to also do with K-Tech. You know, you sort of bust up the rules. Well, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. Well, watch. Just sit, just relax and listen to the story. You know, I mean, the story is the most important part.
No, I love the way you sort of offhand said, and I got the job at the Nashville Public Library. Not very many public libraries have their own puppeteer on staff.
Right.
So, first of all, how did that happen?
Okay. Well, there is a tradition at the Nashville Public Library that began in 1938 with Tom Tischner and his marionettes. Now, if you're familiar with the Broadway musical Carnival in 1961, Tom Tischner was the puppeteer who built those puppets. And he was sort of Nashville's, you know, Mr. Rogers. And he started it when he was a kid in 1938. And then I took over 21 years ago when Tom Tischner passed away. And sort of had to reinvent it and rebuild what he had started. And so we have a team of 10 puppeteers.
10 puppeteers working for the Nashville Public Library.
At least. And there's,
wow.
There's sort of more. There's two puppet trucks that take the shows out into the community. All the shows are free. We do about 12 to 15 programs a week. We have our own dedicated theater, our own dedicated building space. We have, every several years, we have an international puppet festival that has brought from 18 to 21,000 over 3 days. Again, everything is free. And it's because Nashville held on to this wonderful tradition of puppetry that began in 1938 with Tom Tischner, and I'm the lucky one who gets to do it.
To your knowledge, are there any other public libraries in the United States that have a staff puppeteer?
Not. If there is, I don't know about them.
It seems like you would.
Yeah, it seems like where you're just the puppeteer. Mostly, yeah. I got a call from the Toronto Public Library, and they're like, "How are you doing this with the puppets?" Ah, la la la. And so I'm just explaining, and then they say, "No. How do you train the librarians to do the puppet shows?" And I said, "Well, the librarians don't do the puppet shows. They have a staff of puppeteers." And like, "Oh, well, they'll never go for that." You know, it's something that was held on to. And other libraries used to have them across the country, used to have staff of puppeteers. And one by one, they were let go. And as far as I know, Nashville's the only one that has just a dedicated staff. And we have a whole literacy program that came out of it, Bringing Books to Life, where teachers go into the classroom and work with folks. And the kids get copies of the books and build crafts. And then the puppet truck shows up with the puppet show. Again, it's all free. It's a very special program.
Yeah, it sounds extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, sure. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Brian Hull is the director of Bri Animations. He is also the puppeteer of the Nashville Public Library, and he'll be performing K-Tech the Wizard, which is an adaptation of a 1933 children's book with a magical storyline and an incredible backstory as well. Again, he'll be performing at the Great Plains Puppet Train in West Liberty. It begins tomorrow and runs through Sunday. And I want to bring another performer onto the show. Panacea Theriak found her way to puppetry through Christian ministry and punk rock. She is a New Orleans-based puppeteer and performs with her spouse, Robert Rolston. Her stage name is Miss Pussycat, and they'll be performing the Cookie Carnival Baking Contest in West Liberty. Hello, Panacea.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
I just wanted to say, most people would know my husband actually is Quintron.
Okay. So. Miss Pussycat and Quintron.
Or Quintron and Miss Pussycat. That's how we would typically be billed at a show.
Okay. Well, can you tell me a little bit? I mentioned that you're going to be performing the Cookie Carnival Baking Contest. Can you tell me a little bit about the show?
Sure. We're going to do a couple of different shows. We're going to do the Cookie Carnival Baking Contest. on Saturday, and we're also going to be performing the Western Village Shopping Village. And they're two very different shows. The Cookie Carnival Baking Contest, I wanted to make a character that was seemed like you would think, oh, this is the bad guy. It's kind of an underdog character, but its vulnerability is what makes it so good, and everybody just loves the goblin cake. That's the star of the show. And the story is that their shopping bear wants to win the Cookie Carnival Baking Contest because there's a blue ribbon prize and $50,000 goes to the winner. So she uses a really old family recipe, and she bakes a cake, and it takes about a month to bake the cake. And it comes out, and it's black and burnt, and it smells like burnt hair, and it's the goblin cake. And then she enters it into the Cookie Carnival, and there's other contestants, like the birthday cake or the king cake or the jello cake. And there's certain ones that you think, oh, that's going to be the winner, but they're not. So, and there's a tasty test. So that's the Cookie Carnival Baking Contest.
All right. It sounds like a delightful show. I'm so curious, reading about your history, both you and Quintron, your history as puppeteers. I mentioned that you started out doing puppets as part of a Christian puppet youth ministry, but then you started performing outside the church and you started putting on do-it-yourself punk shows at your house, including puppets. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I started out as a kid. I was in the Christian Puppet Youth Ministry, part of the Southern Baptist Church's program for kids. I grew up in Antlers, Oklahoma, and there wasn't a whole lot of things to do. So I did that for a year or two, and it was a kit that the church ordered. But we went on tour, and we practiced after school and took it pretty seriously. And but really, it was just a silly kit with prefabricated puppets that weren't very good telling Bible stories. But it really actually taught me the basics of puppetry. And in a way, what I do now isn't that different. And later on, years later, I moved to New Orleans and I started doing shows in my house. And bands would play, and no band ever wants to go first. It's just a thing. And so one day there was a big show that we were getting ready for, and I was like, you know, I could do a puppet show and it'd be really funny, and I'll go first. And I can throw characters in and kind of make satire of bands as well, or comment on the show. There was a character named Dog Breath, the Evil Wizard Man, and he had Hawkwind's address. And Flossie really wanted it after she used the brain machine. So that was the first puppet show, the beginning. And it just worked. It worked. It was like, okay, the problem solved. Here's something, the show's starting. I'm going to do a puppet show.
And so you still do puppet shows at music festivals, in rock clubs. And we're nearly out of time, but I want to ask you about being a puppeteer for grown-ups. I mean, you do shows for kids as well, but what is special about being a puppeteer for adult audiences?
Well, for me, it's just finding my peer group, my own subculture. I'm on tour right now, actually, and we played in Detroit last night with Gang Gang Dance at L Club, and tonight, actually, we're going to be in Chicago at the Empty Bottle. And I don't know that it's different from performing for children. I think that the audience that's going to be best for any show or artwork or performance is going to be the one that you like, that is your peer group. And then you'll know what they need to get from a show. So these are the people that are the most like me. So
well,
I eat less cake and drink more beer, I guess.
And I'm sure you'll certainly be among your peers at the Great Plains Puppet Train. Panacea,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Panacea Theriac, better known as Miss Pussycat, Quintron and Miss Pussycat. That's the group that she performs with, a New Orleans-based puppeteer, and they'll be performing the Cookie Carnival Baking Contest in West Liberty, along with other performances. And Monica Leo, let's come back around to you. We only have about a minute left, but I asked Sherry, I asked Brian, I want to ask you why you think puppets are so relevant still today. I mean, clearly there are some pretty extraordinary performers coming together for the Great Plains Puppet Train.
I puzzle about that myself, but I find that even though I've been doing this for over 40 years, the kid audiences are no different. In spite of all of the special effects and all of the devices and everything that they have now, they still get just as engaged in a story that can run 45 minutes or more, and just as awed when something really simple, you know, something that you'd think, it's obvious how I did that, but it doesn't really matter. They still are awed and delighted by it. And for me, just like for Brian, it all comes back to the story.
Well, Monica Leo, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity.
Monica Leo of Eulenspiegel Puppet Theater in West Liberty. The Great Plains Puppet Train, a regional puppet festival, is happening in West Liberty. It begins tomorrow and runs through Sunday the 16th. I've been visiting with some of the artists who'll be performing at the festival. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with Temple Grandin, but I also want to take a moment right now to say thank you. Shirley Wong is one of our assistant producers. She's been working with us throughout the summer. She's done extraordinary work for us, and she is leaving us today. So I just want to say thank you for everything, Shirley, and best of luck. We know that the future is very bright. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Temple Grandin is known around the world for her extraordinary understanding of animal behavior. She has transformed the way that we slaughter cattle. In fact, half of the cattle in the United States and Canada are processed in humane handling systems that she designed for meat plants. She's also an activist, raising awareness and advocating for the rights of people on the autism spectrum. She's written a number of best-selling books, including Thinking in Pictures, Animals in Translation. Her most recent book is The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. She is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, and she'll be speaking at Iowa State University Thursday night at the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. The lecture is free and open to the public. It's at 7 p.m., and she is with me on the line now. Hello, Temple.
How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. And for people who are not as familiar with your work, I know that you've told these stories many times, but I would love for you to help us understand a little bit about how you see the world, because it's how you see the world that helps you understand animal behavior so well. And one of the things is that you can see the world in pictures. You have an understanding that doesn't require language. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, if you want to understand animals, you need to get away from language. Everything I think about is a picture. I don't think in words. Words narrate the pictures in my imagination. In fact, as we talk about it right now, I'm seeing the cover of my book, Thinking in Pictures, because I have to have a visual image in order to think. So in animals' world, and it doesn't matter whether it's cattle, pigs, or dog, they're going to store their memories as sensory. Pictures. Dogs will be very much into smell. Maybe cattle are afraid, or a horse are afraid of a certain sound. Animals will often get afraid of something they were either looking at or hearing right when a scary thing happened. In my book, Animals in Translation, I described the black hat horse, and he was abused during a veterinary procedure. So he became afraid of people wearing black cowboy hats. If they had on a white cowboy hat, they were just fine because the animal made a visual picture of the thing he was afraid of. It's specific. It's not generalized.
And I remember learning in various psychology classes, things like that over the years, about the debate over whether animals could think or not. And one of the main arguments from the perspective of people who say animals can't think was that they don't have language and we use language to think. Did you run into that idea when you were studying?
Oh, absolutely, I did. Knowing, well, then I'm going to have to assume that I can't think. I've designed a lot of equipment. And when I design the equipment, I kind of test run it in my head, and I visualize it as I draw it. When I started doing my first work in animal behavior, I noticed cattle would when they went to a handling facility, they'd balk at a shadow, they'd balk at a chain hanging down, a reflection off a vehicle. And when I point those things out to people, people see it. But until I point them out, some people, especially if they're really verbal, have a hard time seeing it. And there is evidence that animals can think, because thinking is solving problems under new novel conditions. There's some very interesting work done in crows, where a crow figures out how to take a stick and stick it down in this little tube and snag a treat that he wants.
When we make that argument that maybe animals can't think because they don't have the language, that also then would apply to many people on the autism spectrum, because many people on the autism spectrum have a difficult time acquiring language. I can't imagine how frustrating that must be for someone after they've acquired the language to learn that so many people's theory of mind is connected to something that they didn't have access to.
Well, you see, there's a lot of people who think you have to have language for thinking. You got to have language in order to have feelings. Animals live in a sensory-based world. I think it's just ridiculous to say that, you know, they cannot think. And I think it gets down to language-based thought versus visual thinking. And in the autism world, and in fact, a lot of gifted people, you can have someone who's a visual thinker like me, kind of careers they'll be good at is design and art. Then you have a person who is the visual spatial mathematical thinker. It's pattern thinking instead of pictures. I think in photorealistic pictures. And there's actual scientific research, and it's in my book, The Autistic Brain, that you can have an object photorealistic visual thinker like me. You can have a pattern mathematical thinker. And then there's also people that think pretty much in words. And a lot of people are combinations of the different kinds of thinking. And when I first started out, I thought everybody thought in pictures like me. Well, it was I finally learned that that's not the case.
And it took quite a while to realize that other people were thinking in different ways, didn't it?
Well, that's right. And I thought, you know, until you start questioning how other people think. And in education, there's a lot of overgeneralization with very verbal-based theories. And I'm getting worried that our kids that are visual thinkers are going to get left out. We're going to need our visual thinkers. We've got a huge shortage in skilled trades. And this brings up another book I have, Calling All Minds, where kids can learn about famous inventors and also just do some of the projects I made as kids. Kids don't make things anymore. They don't make stuff and just figure out how to do something simple, like make a paper airplane work. You got a lot of kids today never even made a paper airplane. Also, they don't know how to tinker and just make mistakes. And that's addressed in Calling All Minds. And that doesn't apply just to people with autism, but maybe the kids that are dyslexic or the kids that get some other special ed label.
You, like many people on the autism spectrum, you acquired language a little bit later than other children. I'm curious, and maybe this isn't something that you can remember because you were such a young child, but as you were learning to put words to your ideas, was it difficult for you to make that connection since you were such a visual thinker? Difficult to put those ideas into language?
Well, I just learned, okay, a dog's a dog. So when I was a little kid, dogs were Labrador Retrievers, Golden Retrievers, a German Shepherd, or an Airedale, because those are the dogs we have in the neighborhood. And gradually other dogs came into the neighborhood, and I could no longer sort the dogs by size when dogs from horses. By size, when a dachshund came into the neighborhood, and she was the same size as a cat. I used to sort cats, dogs, and horses by size, and then I had to figure out what sensory-based feature does a dachshund share with other dogs. She barks, she smells like a dog, and she has the same nose shape. You know, I basically see pictures. You know, now I'm seeing the dachshund. Now I'm seeing my assistant's dogs. They come up sort of just the way the HBO movie shows it. They kind of come up like a series of PowerPoint slides that I can click through.
I feel like we've learned so much about autism in recent years, and we certainly
are diagnosing autism more often, and there's a debate that could be made about whether we're in the midst of an epidemic or whether that's also driven by diagnosis or both.
I think some of it's driven by diagnosis. I worked with a lot of skilled, very quirky tradespeople on some of the big projects I did at the beef plants. And those kids today are kind of getting shunted into special ed because they don't have a welding class anymore. You wouldn't have a radio station to talk on if it wasn't for autism genetics. Because the people who are interested in building a radio station to start with are not the people that do the talking in the radio station. You've got an engineer back there that's got to keep your station running. And a lot of those people are probably mildly on the autism spectrum.
I'm curious how you feel about the diagnosis of autism, because the spectrum is so broad. How useful is it to have this diagnosis?
Well, there's a problem, because half of Silicon Valley programmers probably have mild autism. And then the spectrum goes all the way to somebody who can't dress themselves, all got the same name. And I'm getting worried where a lot of geeky, nerdy kids today are letting the diagnosis become their total identity. Well, I'd rather have the identity be musician, artist, clever person who builds things out of metal. You know, for me, being a college professor comes first and the autism is second. And when I was first starting my career, a movie showed those cattle pens. And I was putting cattle pens on myself because the cattle came first.
The diagnosis of autism, I mean, we have these ideas about it, those of us who are not intimately acquainted or related to someone on the spectrum. There is...
You know, you're getting too hung up. I think you're one of the reasons you're in radio is because you're verbal. You know,
that's,
I don't get hung
that's
up
so
on the
true.
Words going, okay, the kid's 6 years old. Can he talk? What's he good at? Now, basically in autism, some of the social circuits aren't hooked up. But maybe the music, math, or art circuits are really hooked up. So let's build up on that. We got to teach him social skills like he's in a foreign country. I'm talking to many granddads that come up to me and find out they're on the autism spectrum who have had a successful career. Because my generation was taught social skills in a much more systematic way. In fact, after I do this call, we're going to be having a seminar just on how to greet people at interviews, because even the normal kids are not getting this. It hurts the autistic kids a lot more. Take the thing the kid's good at and expand on it.
So what I'm curious about, I mean, we've made a lot of progress, but we still have so many people on the autism spectrum who...
We've always had them.
Right.
On the mild end of the spectrum, they've always been there.
But who cannot get work. And I'm curious, where have we failed that these people who have skills can't work?
We've taken all the skilled trades out of the schools in some districts, taken art out, taken theater out, all the kinds of things that they're music, things where these kids could get jobs. And we have a huge shortage of skilled trades, things like plumbers, electricians, welders who can read blueprints, you know, the highly skilled trades. I worked with people back in the 90s when I was out in construction projects all the time. That is, kids, they would have been on the autism spectrum, or dyslexic, or ADHD.
So what do you think we can do? How can we fix this problem?
Well, kids have got to learn how to work. That's another very big problem. That needs to start around 11 years old with volunteer jobs. Instant and legal, they need to get jobs just so they learn how to show up on time and work. And learn that skill before they graduate from high school.
If we don't have programs in place to teach them, then how are they going to gain those skills? I mean, do you think that this is something that our schools need to revisit?
I think there's some real problems with this. And maybe there's a lot of retirees around. Maybe we need to get a retired auto mechanic to set up a shop in his garage and teach the neighborhood kids how to fix cars or how to do some other skill. Because I have been in three hotels in the last year in major cities where the water system failed, and it was due to the infrastructure failing out in the street. That used to never happen before.
You have been spending a lot of time and writing and thinking and speaking about the autism spectrum and advocating for people on the autism spectrum. it feels like there is a real movement growing. What do you feel good about with that right now?
Well, I think it's good, and I want to see kids get out there and be successful and not have their whole identity just become the fact that they're autism spectrum, because I know people that own metal fabrication companies and businesses that have, and we've discussed it, where when they were a kid, they would have had a diagnosis. You see, the problem we've got now is you're going from somebody who's very severely challenged with very big handicaps, maybe can't talk, can't dress themselves, to somebody who ought to be working in Silicon Valley